Our job is to get the airway.
We still don't have a randomized trial that has compared succinylcholine versus rocuronium.
Airway articles are difficult. It's knowing that the drug is on your side and not going to wear off. But it's not the first pass, it's the second pass you have to worry about. I don't even mentally want to take that risk. That's the kiss of death.
Well, welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, literally sitting in the School of Medicine in downtown Baltimore, recording this podcast. Once again, I am so happy to welcome Dr. Ken Butler, a beloved colleague here with me in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Maryland. He is currently an associate professor of emergency medicine and one of our stellar associate residency directors. We have had Ken on in the past year. You may recall a few months ago, we brought him on to discuss the PREVENT trial with respect to bag mask ventilation in critically ill patients during that induction to just before laryngoscopy. So he gave us his expert opinion, lots of great feedback on that, and we've got him back on this podcast to talk about yet another RSI-related question. So Ken, welcome back to the podcast.
Michael, thank you, and greetings to all your readers. This is wonderful. And listeners, thank you.
Can't wait to discuss this hotly debated topic that seems to have been debated for, well, perhaps even since I was back in residency close to, 20 years ago.
Right.
So the question specifically arises, it's based on a recent article or a recent trial called the Curasmer trial. This has gotten a lot of discussion across the social media, the blogospheres, the podcasts. It was just published in JAMA just a few months ago, and the lead author is Gilhard, and it is titled The Effect of Rocuronium versus Succinylcholine on Endotracheal Intubation Success Rates Among Patients Undergoing Out-of-Hospital Rapid Sequence Intubation. So just by way of background, before I turn it over to Ken for his expert analysis, we know that in patients in the ED, in the ICU, and in the pre-hospital setting that are critically ill who need airway intervention, rapid sequence intubation is really the recommended sedation technique. We know that when we use a neuromuscular blocking agent, overall, it provides us with better intubating conditions. We do know from studies that it produces higher first attempt success rates, regardless of what we end up using as the sedative, whether that be etomidate, ketamine, propofol, or what have you. In years past, we had typically used succinylcholine, and dare I say that many providers out there listening to this podcast still utilize succinylcholine as their preferred neuromuscular blocking agent in the setting of RSI. However, over the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen the surge of the utilization of rocuronium as an alternative to succinylcholine, and it's really, for many, has also become a favorite and their go-to neuromuscular blocking agent in the setting of RSI. And when we use rocuronium at an adequate dose, so at least 1.2 milligrams per kilogram, the onset or the time of onset is very similar to that of succinylcholine. We know that, and all of you know, that there are certain adverse events, namely hyperkalemia associated with succinylcholine, and so many have recommended strictly going or utilizing rocuronium for emergency department, pre-hospital, and often ICU intubations. But we still don't have a randomized trial that has compared succinylcholine versus rocuronium in emergency settings. So that brings us to the Curasmer trial, the trial that we're going to turn things over to Dr. Butler and have him provide an expert analysis, because this specific trial, these investigators set out to compare rocuronium versus succinylcholine use in emergency out-of-hospital intubation. So the specifics about the study, this was a nationwide, single-blind, randomized, non-inferiority clinical trial where the investigators set their non-inferiority threshold at 7%. This was conducted at 17 out-of-hospital emergency medical units in France. Now, importantly, what do I mean by single-blind? Well, patients obviously were blinded to the intervention assignment, whether they were receiving succinylcholine or rocuronium, but the physicians conducting the intubation were not blinded. And as many of you know, EMS systems in France are a little bit different from other locations around the world. So EMS within France, an oversimplification is that in essence, they have a two-tiered system. Their first level is a BLS unit, and that's usually a fire department service. Their second level is an ALS unit that is staffed with a nurse that and also can sometimes be a certified registered nurse anesthetist and an EM and anesthesiology physician. So who did they include in this study? All out-of-hospital patients requiring emergency intubation where EMS arrived on scene, and that could include intubations for trauma, for coma, for overdoses, for overt critical illness, and shock. They did not include those less than 18 years of age, so pediatric patients, those who are pregnant, and those in cardiac arrest, or, I'm not sure how they would know this, but some contraindication to ROCK uronium or succinylcholine. They were then randomized to either ROCK or succinylcholine. Both groups received sedative induction along with pre-oxygenation, and in general, it was recommended to use either etomidate or ketamine. What the protocol called for is the sedative would be administered, and then 60 seconds after the administration of the paralytic agent, intubation would be performed using DL with a MAC blade. Now, secondary airway adjuncts such as a bougie, an intubating LMA or cricothyrotomy were allowed, and then patients had some standard level of sedation following intubation. So what were the outcomes? What's the primary outcome of the CURASMR trial? Overall, they wanted to look at the percentage of patients with successful first attempt orotracheal intubation assessed by the physician who was performing that intubation along with confirmation by capnography. A few important secondary outcomes: what was the overall difficulty of the intubation process, what were the intubating conditions, and then how many patients actually needed intubation by these alternative techniques, i.e. utilization of the bougie, utilization of an intubating LMA. So Ken, with that, that's the study, that's the background, that's the details of who they included and excluded and their primary outcomes. Long overdue, but let's bring you into the discussion here. What were the results and what are the important take-home things that you want to emphasize in this particular trial?
So first of all, Mike, thank you. And I have to say this, airway articles are difficult. And just please hear my thought. You would have to literally do the exact same patient, same provider, same adjunct or equipment or dosing. And then if you could, fictitiously, then redo it to see if you failed first attempt to second attempt. That's impossible to do. So my hat's off to anybody that publishes good airway data. But let's look carefully at this paper, and I'll tell you my thoughts. One, this is out of hospital, which is a little bit different than our system. Grant you, the French look at EMS much differently. And I found it interesting that over 50% of these patients were comatose, and the other 20% that they wrote about were a drug overdose. So what I'm saying to myself is, where is this either low cardiac or pulmonary reserve or someone acutely short of breath? And we're going to come back to the comatose patient when we talk about sux side effects. And Michael, as you said, the physician was not blinded on what he was giving or which drug was given. So that I wince a little bit because he or she didn't know. But let's get further. There's no time between the administration of drug and the passage of the endotracheal tube that was ever recorded. So if you're going to say that you failed first attempt, you have to look at it over time. Did you have 1 minute to do it, 30 seconds, 10 seconds? I don't know where that is in a failed airway in this particular paper. Two, they either used a MAC 3 or a MAC 4. And my school of thought is a MAC 4 has a higher success rate because of the length of the blade. If we get into a floppy epiglottic view, we can use the MAC 4 as a Miller and never have to change hands. If we started with a MAC 3, we don't have that option. As I go down my list, please, there was never a stylet that was used on these patients, and all of them, it seemed, had a Selleck maneuver done. Now, we know that the people that listen to airway management, we've kind of poo-pooed cricoid pressure for many reasons, and even our colleagues in anesthesia have poo-pooed it for so many reasons. So I can't put that into light of helping or hurting anybody. My point is it should not have been done. This 7% number that they used was very much an opinion by them for what criteria was met for this to say that it was non-inferior. There's no hardcore data that comes and says you have to have a number greater than, I'm making this up again, 7 to say that. So I don't know where that was. As I move down again, there is no specific criteria for first pass in this paper. So again, I don't know what they meant by that. And I am quarterbacking because if you're going to use this for first pass success rate, you have to have criteria of what deemed first pass success rate. Is it just getting past a tooth? Let's look at the drugs for a moment. So dosing a little bit low, and then people that know me know my school of thought, is you can really never underdose on a paralytic. And I'm going to come back to this specifically, but dosing I would have liked to see higher on both ends of the drugs personally, but I'll leave that alone. If you look at SUCs, those patients had a higher rate of hypotension and complications. And in a head patient, hence these 50% of comatose patients, this paper never looked at the outcomes after the intubation, meaning that was hypotension causing an increase in morbidity or mortality? And we know that it does in TBI, clearly in comatose patients. We never want a drop of blood pressure. So those are my hardcore rules about this paper. So let's look at the bottom line of this. This is me speaking in my opinion. And again, I don't really think it's about first pass. And that's going to maybe get some of your listeners to give me that dog hearing a high-pitched noise look, because it's really about second pass. What do I mean by that? If you gave sucks and you failed the airway, you have to go to a second attempt. We all agree to that. But now the drug is wearing off. Now the patient's bottoming out their blood pressure, as this paper tells us. Maybe now they're bucking or biting the tube, and now you have to redose this agent. And many of us don't know the second dose. We get into trouble. So let's look back at SUCs. SUCs outside of the hyperkalemia that Dr. Winters and I live in downtown inner city USA, where if you came to our ER, maybe about 30% of our patients have renal failure. So we want to take this little bump of potassium increase in SUCs off the table, especially if somebody's acidotic or sepsis. But moving forward, SUCs, we have this shorter apnea time. We use SUCs. These people are apneic for a very short period of time. And if I needed to either use a rescue ventilation device or do a second attempt, I don't have that buffer of an option, meaning that I have to redose a paralytic. I say this often. I think if you made the decision to paralyze your patient, you have all these other variables about dropping somebody's blood pressure and changing their indices when they're intubated. I don't want the drug to cause that. So I don't think SUCS safety factor in 2020 is really on our front lines anymore. I really think it belongs back in the OR, which is a wonderful place for it to be. But if you've made that decision and you're worried about a failed airway, SUCS to me is clearly not your friend. So this isn't about drug dosing, because again, if we look at the numbers of these two cases, we look at the standard dose of ROCK or SUCS. They both go down in that magic 1 minute that we like. We've kind of proven that on paper. But what we don't like is the back end of this, is that when you have a depolarizing agent that wears off so quickly and you get into trouble, this is a bad scenario to be at. And I think that's our safety profile. And to me, this is what this paper is looking at. People that got SUCS had a high rate of complications from hypotension to cardiac arrest. So it's saying in lieu to me that I understand this first pass rate, but it's not the all-out drug that has a high safety profile.
So just to recap some of the hard numbers from the results, Ken, you just went through an outstanding analysis and the concerns leading into that. Just so everybody is aware, the results of this trial, they had about 1,250 patients enrolled in the study, and then ultimately they used a little over 1,220 in their analysis. And that primary outcome, once again, first attempt orotracheal intubation success. In the ROCK group, it was 74.6% versus 79.4% in the succinylcholine group. So the authors reported that it did not meet that inferiority threshold of 7%. And as Ken, you mentioned, in terms of the secondary outcomes, there didn't appear to be any difference between the groups in the difficulty of intubation or how frequently the providers needed to use those alternative intubation techniques. But in the succinylcholine group, there was more intubation-related complications reported within the first 15 minutes. So just to give our readers background and the hard numbers about a lot of the things that you led into this discussion with. Now, let me ask you, in terms of moving forward, you teach an airway course monthly here and quarterly and sometimes even semi-annually, but one of the groups of folks that you bring in specifically are a group of pre-hospital providers, and they are from maybe perhaps not only around Maryland, but from other states as well, come here to learn from you and your colleagues in your airway course. What are you teaching the pre-hospital providers that are listening to this podcast and now aware of this particular study of ROCK versus SUCKS in the pre-hospital setting.
Thanks, Mike. For EMS, and please, I am not an EMS fellow graduate, so I say this, I've learned that over the years, that if I took a group of people that are really hungry for education and don't have funding or any go-to people, it clearly is EMS throughout the United States. And Mike is right, I teach a group out of Florida that has gotten grants and their state comes to us 4 times a year. But many of their directors for their EMS and their regional directors have come to our course and have all changed over to ROCK Uranium. And I think that I've planted that seed, as you would hear, and it's followed through, and it really makes me happy. And the ones that have, we get data back from them. We do this kind of survey online with them that they follow up on their intubations and how many they've done after the course and ease, and more importantly, their complicated rates, and they use SUCKS, and they all seem to be very happy with that. So as a drug, that's what we teach now.
And would you say the same would apply for in the emergency department and potentially also in the ICU?
First question, for the ER, I think Dr. Winters knows is that all our residents grew up with ROCK Uranium, and SUCKS, even though we have it, is rarely ever used. Understood. And maybe you're thoughting about a potential seizure patient, but I still think you have a safety of that 30 minutes duration because our job is to get the airway. The seizure, if you will, in that scenario that you're worried about a longer acting drug really follows second. So let's back up. The unit people, and I so respect them, their job is to get someone off a paralytic. So having something that has a little bit longer duration to them, they kind of wince a little bit. I so respect that. But our job, or people that are listening to your podcast, your job is to get the airway. And again, I think that my statement about it's not the first pass, it's the second pass you have to worry about. Meaning that maybe your success rate is very high, but if you've had failed airways, and I clearly have in my career, it's knowing that the drug is on your side and not going to wear off, and the patient isn't going to wake up and buck and bite and desat and drop their pressure. That's the kiss of death.
Do you find that in recent years, or even moving forward, are there any indications or scenarios where you could envision that succinylcholine would be preferred in your mind?
You know, Mike, I can't say that. Again, you and I have been here for, or I've been here for at least 2 decades, and I look at inner city USA and our percentage of renal failure sitting in our ER across the street from where we're doing this podcast, and I don't even mentally want to take that risk. Yes, it's very small, and I get that. But if you take a known renal failure patient who comes in profoundly short of breath and can't tell us what they have, there's no time for labs, and they're acidotic because they're septic, I don't want a drug to bump any electrolyte. And more importantly, I want the drug to last so I can equilibrate the vent during this peri-intubation or this resuscitation before intubation period.
Well, thanks so much, Ken. And just one other thing in terms of limitations, you mentioned a lot of them, but from the author standpoint, they certainly highlight the fact that this wasn't a double-blinded trial. So obviously the physician knew which drug was being administered. And as we led off in terms of the study details, EMS units in France are different than many locations around the world. And often they do have an emergency medicine physician or anesthesiologist as the ALS person responding on scene. And as Ken highlighted, they selected a 7% non-inferiority margin based upon their best guess and their best opinion. I wouldn't say guess, but best opinion in evaluating the literature. But this is certainly an important trial. It is one of those first randomized trials taking a look at ROCK versus SUCKS in the out-of-hospital setting. So lots further to deep dive, Ken. This has been exceedingly helpful. Really, any airway paper I look at, I come to you in terms of your analysis, and this has been outstanding in terms of talking about this. I'm already looking forward, quite honestly, to our next discussion because hot off the press, you and I haven't had a chance to do a deep dive into this particular study that was just published online in Academic Emergency Medicine, taking a look at VL versus DL, and maybe we've finally arrived at an answer at which one is better, but we're going to save that as a teaser for our next podcast. What
That's
do you
great.
Think?
I like it, because that, I think, is going to give us a lot of controversy. It's going to be like the SUCKS in ROCK was 10 years ago, so it'll be good.
All right. Well, if any of you have questions for Ken, please shoot them through the website. I'll get them over to him for his expert analysis and response to your questions. But our thanks for listening to this podcast on the Curasmer trial. Once again, an honor to have Ken here on the podcast. We're going to wrap things up. Once again, Mike Winters sitting here at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Looking forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.